Hello, this is Miss Dell with the Herald Decatur. Oops, huh? Oh. He's reading with the front page of the article headlined "Eyes on the Storms." Volunteers trained to ID severe weather beyond radar indicated. There are some storm spotting classes coming up. 6:30 March 26 Galesburg, 6:30 March 30th Jacksonville, 6:30 March 31st Lincoln, 6:30 April 1st Monticello, 6:30 April 7th Champaign, 6:30 April 8th Decatur, 10 a.m. April 11th virtual class, 6:30 p.m. April 14th Bartonville, and 6:30 p.m. April 15th Altamont. From the National Weather Service Central Illinois, Bloomington, National Weather Service radar system in Lincoln has a pretty large geographical scope. It goes out 120 to 150 nautical miles, and Mike Albano, meteorologist with the Regional Weather Office, it's going to try to intercept or scatter different hydrometeorological targets, which is simply raindrops or hail, could be snowflakes. It also picks up birds, insects, and yes, wind turbines, he said. Not only the tip of the blade, but also the turbulence above that, he said. A lot of people don't realize we can see a lot of things with Doppler radar. Despite its far sight, radar has limitations, Albano said, which is why the National Weather Service regularly trains volunteer storm spotters to be the office's eyes and ears during storm season. More than 80 people signed up for just such a class Saturday, March 14th, at the McLean County Emergency Operations Center below the Law and Justice Center in downtown Bloomington, including first responders, seasoned spotters, and first-timers alike. It's often having this many people here, said Kathy Beck, director of the county's Emergency Management Agency, way bigger turnout than we're expecting. We'll see rotation, we'll see mesocyclone, we'll see it spinning like a top, but rotation doesn't equal tornado, Mike Albano, National Weather Service meteorologist. Interested storm spotters attend classes curated by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration each spring. After they can apply to work with local officials like county EMAs to help keep public informed about storms in their areas. The need for human help. Just by radar's design and function, it will have a clearer picture of objects like storm cells that are closer to the radar site than cells over greater distances, Albano said. The farther away you get from our radar, that beam will spread out. Just the physics of what it is. Also, the curvature of the Earth. As you get further away from the radar site, the curvature of the Earth starts to overshoot the critical part of the storm, he says. For example, the radar in Lincoln cannot detect anything in Bloomington Normal that is below 2,000 feet above ground level. Albano said, we'll see the rotation, we'll see the mesocyclone, he said, we'll see it spinning like a top, but rotation doesn't equal tornado. A mesocyclone is a radar term used to describe a storm-scale region of rotation, typically around 2 to 6 miles in diameter, and often found in the right rear flank of a supercell. Its circulation covers an area much larger than a tornado, which may develop within it, according to the National Weather Service. Albano noted, it's something like 15% or less of all mesocyclones produce tornadoes. When officials at the Weather Service and EMA see a mesocyclone, they will reach out to their spotters, Beck said. Most of those teams have key spots where they go because they can see the most coming towards them, she said. That might change based on the direction the storm is coming from, but they have areas identified ahead of time. In Bloomington Normal, proper trained spotters are first responders with both the fire and police departments, Beck said. Outside the Twin Cities, though, there are 27 regions, each led by what Beck calls ESDA spotters. ESDA stands for Emergency Services and Disaster Agency, and was the acronym that was used before it was replaced by EMA. But Beck said, we're still kind of differentiate by calling the rural communities ESDA. One of those teams has a primary and backup ESDA spotter who will manage their team of trained spotters and report back to EMA, which in turn works with NWS to relay the information to the public, Beck said. The power of human help. The information that trained spotters provide, including clarity of what a storm may actually look like, can save lives, Albano said. On the evening of May 22, 2011, an EF5 tornado ripped through Joplin, Missouri, some 140 miles south of Kansas City. It was one of the deadliest in history, according to the National Weather Service. Catastrophic tornado, Albano said. Over 120 people lost their life in Joplin. We found out, the social sciences told us, people need more than one source of information to take action. Which means, when we send out a tornado warning or severe thunderstorm warning, even and the source of the radar is indicated only, that's not necessarily enough for somebody to heed the warning to take shelter. That is especially true in the Midwest, where residents have a habit of running to see the storm in person, Albano said, citing his own childhood experience. But if a severe storm warning has visual confirmation, suddenly we go from radar indicated to trained spotter indicated. We hope that this is an extra source of information for folks who take action to heed the warning and take shelter, Albano said. Severe weather that swept through Illinois during the week of March 8th actually motivated many people to attend the storm spotter training, Beck said. Registration was about half of what it is today prior to last week's storm, she said. The National Weather Service recommends trained spotters attend a refresher training session every other year, Beck said. Even if those in attendance do not apply to become spotters for EMA, these trainings are also good for general awareness, Beck said. It's also just a great way to get more information, especially for kids or people that have storm anxiety, she said. Knowledge is power. Our next front page story, Iran ups attacks after threats. Strikes land in southern Israel as key energy infrastructure targeted. Arad Israel. Iran and the allied Lebanese militant group Hezbollah stepped up attacks on Israel on Sunday after the United States and Iran threatened to target critical infrastructure in the war in the Middle East, now in its fourth week. Iran said the Strait of Hormuz, crucial to oil and other exports, would be completely closed immediately if the U.S. follows up on President Donald Trump's new threat to attack its power plants. Trump set a 48-hour deadline late Saturday to open the strait. Iran's parliament speaker said Tehran also would retaliate against U.S. and Israeli energy and wider infrastructure in the region. Israeli leaders visited Arad, one of the two southern communities near the secretive nuclear research site struck by Iranian missiles late Saturday, wounding scores of people. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said it was a miracle no one was killed. He claimed Israel and the U.S. were well on their way to achieving their war goals and asked the international community for more support. The developments signaled the war, which the U.S. and Israel launched February 28th, was moving in a dangerous new direction despite Trump's comment last week he was considering winding down operations. It killed more than 2,000 people so far, rattled the global economy, and sent oil prices surging. Hezbollah claimed responsibility for an airstrike that killed a man in northern Israel, while Gulf Arab states, including Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, said they intercepted new Iranian strikes. Plants threatened. Iran practically closed the Strait of Hormuz that connects the Persian Gulf to the rest of the world. About one-fifth of global oil supply passes through it, but attacks on ships and threats of further strikes stopped almost all tanker traffic. Some of the largest oil producers made cuts because their crude has gone nowhere to go. Iranian officials said they would keep providing safe passage through the strait to vessels from countries and other than its enemies. The U.S. and its allies in Europe and Asia rely heavily on the oil to meet energy demand. In its most recent attempt to relieve pressure on energy prices, the U.S. lifted some sanctions on Iranian oil at sea. Trump said on social media, if Iran didn't open the strait, the U.S. would destroy its various power plants, starting with the biggest one first. Iranian Parliament Speaker Mohammad Bagher Kalibaf responded that if Iran's power plants and infrastructure are targeted, then vital infrastructure across the region, including energy and desalination facilities, would be considered legitimate targets if irreversibly destroyed. Under international law, power plants that benefit civilians can be targeted only if the military advantage outweighs the suffering it causes to civilians, legal scholars say. Nuclear concerns. Iran said its strikes on the Negev Desert late Saturday were in retaliation for an earlier attack on Iran's main nuclear enrichment site in the Natanz, according to state-run media. Tehran praised the attack as show of strength, even as Israel's military asserts that Iranian missile launches gradually decreased in frequency since the war began. If the Israeli regime is unable to intercept missiles in the heavily protected Dimona area, it is operationally a sign of entering a new phase of the battle, Kalibaf said. Southern Israel's main hospital received at least 175 wounded from Arad and Dimona, its deputy director Roy Kessos told the Associated Press. Israel is widely believed to possess nuclear weapons, though it doesn't confirm or deny their existence. The UN nuclear watchdog said on social media it didn't receive reports of damage to the Israeli center or abnormal radiation levels. Israel denied responsibility for hitting Natanz on Saturday, while the Iranian Dictionary's official news agency, Mizan, said there was no leakage. The Pentagon declined to comment on the strike. The International Atomic Energy Agency has said the bulk of Iran's estimated 972 pounds of enriched uranium is elsewhere beneath the rubble at its Isfahan facility. Iran says hospital hit. Iran said strikes hit the hospital in Adamisk. Its health ministry said patients and doctors were evacuated to another city. Iran's death toll in the war surpassed 1,500, state media reported Saturday, citing the ministry. In Israel, Iranian strikes killed 15 people so far. More than a dozen civilians in the occupied West Bank and Gulf Arab states were killed in strikes. The Qatari military helicopter crash on Saturday, blamed on a technical malfunction, killed all seven aboard, Qatari authorities said. Hezbollah strike. The Israeli civilian was killed in the northwestern town of Misgam Am in what the Israel's military said seemed to be a rocket attack. Hezbollah launched strikes on Israel soon after the war began, calling it retaliation for the killing of Iran's supreme leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. Israel then targeted Hezbollah in deadly strikes and expanded its ground presence in southern Lebanon. Fighting there has intensified. Israel on Sunday expanded its list of targets to include all bridges over Litani River, which Defense Minister Israel Katz and Hezbollah is using to move fighters and weapons into the south. Israel later struck the Qasmiya Bridge near Tyre, giving an hour's warning. Katz also ordered the military to accelerate its destruction of Lebanese homes near Israel's northern border. Lebanon authorities say Israel's strikes killed more than 1,000 people and displaced more than 1 million. Hezbollah has fired hundreds of rockets into Israel. Still on the front page, our next article, case may shift how mail votes are counted, the U.S. Supreme Court. There will be just one election day for this fall's midterm elections, November 3rd, but voters in 14 states who cast their votes by mail will be given a grace period ranging from a day later to several weeks in which their ballots can be received and counted. Whether that extra time should be allowed is the heart of the case that will be argued Monday before the U.S. Supreme Court. If the court strikes down those grace periods, it will leave those states and their voters scrambling to adjust with only a few months before absentee ballots are sent for this fall's midterm elections. The implications could extend well beyond the 14 states that give a grace period for regular ballots, depending on how the court ultimately rules. A total of 29 states allow for the late arrival of military and overseas ballots, according to the National Conference of State Legislators and the Voting Rights Lab. In a filing with the court, a group of state and big city election officials cited the risks of confusion if a mail ballot grace periods were ended suddenly in states where voters have counted on them for years. The practice of counting ballots after Election Day has been a target of President Donald Trump since he sought to stop the count after the 2020 election. He and his allies argue it delays results and leads to suspicions about vote tallies. It's part of Trump's broader attack on the most mail balloting, which he has said breeds fraud despite findings to the contrary, and years of experience in numerous states. The Republican National Committee and the Libertarian Party of Mississippi brought the lawsuit against Mississippi Secretary of State Michael Watson, a Republican, arguing that federal election day statutes envision a single day for casting ballots. Grace period for receiving mail ballots, also in place in the District of Columbia and three U.S. territories, violate federal law, they argue. Election Day is Election Day for a reason, Ohio State Senator Teresa Gavarone, a Republican, said during debate over her state's ban on the practice last year. Allowing ballots to be delivered days after the election does nothing to hurt the integrity and credibility of our elections. In briefs supporting Mississippi, voting rights groups, local election officials, and organizations representing military and overseas voters defend the right of states to write their own voting rules. The Constitution gives states the authority to set the time, place, and manner of elections. Supporters of ballot grace periods told the court that upholding the U.S. Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals decision to strike down Mississippi's law would threaten to create chaos and confusion in this year's midterm elections. All 50 states require ballots to be cast or postmarked on or before Election Day. The 14 states with grace periods for regular ballots accept and count mailed ballots for periods ranging from a single day after the election in Texas to 21 days afterward in Washington state. Mississippi's disputed grace period is 5 days. A November 2025 Brookings Institution study found that mail voting was practical, secure the way to expand voter access, with about 4 cases of fraud out of every 10 million mail ballots. It was an option used by about 30% of voters across the U.S. during the 2024 presidential election. With the Mississippi case looming, some states have begun to act on their own. 4 states, Ohio, Kansas, North Dakota, and Utah, eliminated grace periods last year, according to the National Conference of State Legislators and Voting Rights Lab. A 5th, Minnesota, shortened its ballot deadline from the close of polls on Election Day to 5 p.m. In signing Ohio's law, Republican Governor Mike DeWine, who had voted he wouldn't sign any more election restrictions championed by fellow Republicans, the Mississippi lawsuit forced his hand. I believe that this 4-day grace period is reasonable, and I think for many reasons it makes a lot of sense, he said at the time, noting that he would prefer to veto the legislation. But DeWine said a ruling against Mississippi would jeopardize similar laws in other states, including Ohio, and leave inadequate time to adjust. For Adrian Molenkamp, Ohio's previous grace period provided extra comfort for concerns that circumstances outside her control would prevent her ballot from counting. I live in a rural part of the state, and sometimes our mail has to go to a larger city and then come back, said Molenkamp, 48, a stay-at-home mom and volunteer in Athens, who is not affiliated with either major party. It gave me a safe feeling because even if I do my due diligence and return it in enough time, I can't always anticipate what it does when it leaves my hands. Katie Owens Hubler, Elections Program Director at the National Conference of State Legislators, said that in some large states, it can be difficult to distribute all mailed ballots and have them returned within the allotted time frame. She said the postmark issue has become trickier for states after recent changes to mail processing at the U.S. Postal Service. An updated agency policy enacted in December said postmarks might not indicate the first day the Postal Service receives the mail, but rather the day it was handled at one of its processing centers. Those centers can be farther away from some communities because of consolidations, a group of U.S. senators told the Postmaster earlier this year. In response to potential Postal Service processing delays, some states have proposed extending their ballot deadlines, California by 3 days, Virginia by 5 hours, and Kansas by an hour, depending on county, according to the NCSL. And now our next article. Trade with Cuba plunges under White House pressure. Lack of fuel leads to blackouts, disrupts medical care. In Miami, a Cuban Communist Party has shown an astonishing resilience over 6 decades in power. Whether it's the United States trade embargo to counter Fidel Castro's 1959 revolution or a widespread starvation of the special period that followed the breakup of its Cold War patron, the Soviet Union, both U.S. hostilities and calamities of its own making have proven no match for the country's leadership. But perhaps none of those crises pose as grave a threat as the one triggered by an all-but-declared naval siege by Trump administration as it seeks to force regime change in the wake of its ousting the Cuba longtime ally Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. Even as he fights a war in Iran, President Donald Trump this past week said he believes he'll have the honor of taking Cuba soon. While it wasn't clear exactly what he meant, the U.S. is looking for President Miguel Díaz-Canel to leave power as part of ongoing talks with Havana that could avert military intervention. Without declaring formal blockade, Trump and his administration have already crippled trade with the island. In March, supplies of oil, food, and other goods to the island collapsed, with no foreign originating tankers arriving to Cuba, according to shipping data analyzed by Windward, the maritime intelligence firm. The volume of port calls, which includes tankers moving from one Cuban port to another, averaged around 50 per month in 2025, but fell to 11 in March, all of them arriving from domestic ports. Moreover, little relief is in sight, with no tankers and only three container ships originating in China, India, and the Netherlands, listing Cuba as their intended harbor. The stranglehold is disrupting the lives of Cubans, 11 million residents, who are enduring massive blackouts and a breakdown of medical care due to the lack of fuel to power ambulances and hospital generators. The country, one of the most heavily reliant in the world on oil to generate electricity, produces barely 40% of the oil needed to cover its energy needs. The sudden halt in trade has taken place without the White House reapplying restrictions on exports to Cuba that were last loosened during the Biden administration. Indeed, shipments of U.S.-produced poultry, pork, and other foodstuffs to Cuba last year soared to 490 million, the most since 2009. Non-agricultural exports and humanitarian donations, much of it to Cuba's emerging private sector, more than doubled. But, emboldened by the U.S. capture of Maduro, Trump has escalated his rhetoric on Cuba, first suggesting he would pursue a friendly takeover of the country, and more recently telling conservative allies from Latin America that he would take care of Cuba once the war with Iran winds down. While neither he nor the administration has articulated what that means, the presence in the Caribbean of U.S. warships has led companies and countries to do business with Cuba to self-police. Nobody wants to be on the radar of Trump's Truth Social account, said John Kavalich, president of the New York-based U.S.-Cuba Trade and Economic Council. In the run-up to U.S. military ousting of Maduro in early January, Trump declared that the U.S. would block all Venezuelan oil shipments to Cuba and even seized a few tankers. Later in the month, Trump signed an executive order threatening tariffs on any country that supplies oil to Cuba. Cuba has upped its rhetoric against what it calls a fuel blockade by the U.S., but the Trump administration has disputed that characterization, no doubt aware that according to international law, any naval operation seen as punishing civilians is considered an illegal act of aggression outside wartime. Cuba is a free, independent and sovereign state. Nobody dictates what we do, Díaz-Canel said in a social media post in January. Cuba does not attack. We are the victims of U.S. attacks for 66 years, and we will prepare ourselves to defend the homeland with our last drop of blood. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half of the Decatur Herald and Review. Please stay tuned.